Today I'm in Laycock with Dr. Shona Beaumont, who is going to tell me about being the Bishop Potter Scholar as her first thing, because I don't know, can't explain it.
I often get asked that question, like, what on earth is a job with a title like that going to be about? It means I'm something like a postdoc fellow, so I'm doing research as a result of having finished my PhD last year, particularly in this case in theology and the visual arts. And the Bishop Otter bit is because I'm employed by the Bishop of Chichester, Bishop Martin, to do this, and it's a 2-year appointment, nominally based in Chichester, but I get to do most of my work from home, which is Laycock. So it's a perfect position to keep my head in books and things for now.
That's great. Where did we first meet?
Well, I was trying to remember that. It was either outside our front door with you and your Land Rover,
I think that probably was it.
About to be loaded up with gear to go on Soul Survivor Camp. Or it was at Soul Survivor itself.
I think it was here first.
It was here, was it?
It was here first.
I knew it was either cars or barbecue. That was my first association with you.
I did either bring or collect a crate of bread at some point.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
But I think that was after I'd...
That was about 20 loaves we had in our freezer just for young people.
Yes. Yeah, well, we got through it all, yeah. So it was great. Do you drink tea?
I am a tea fanatic. I say that. I don't know much about fancy teas, and I don't have much patience for smelly varieties, but good old builder's tea, yes. That I've got memories of that being the first drink I had when I gave birth. I've got memories of that being the first thing I drank when I handed in my PhD thesis. I grew up in Kenya, so I've got memories of living near plantations, tea plantations. And it's just all around the best possible drink in the world, quite frankly.
So if you had a favourite cup of tea, so that could be a time of day cup of tea or a type of tea, what would your favourite be?
Well, it does depend on work level or health level. Favourite cups of tea, when you're feeling slightly muggy and coldy and sniffly in the middle of winter, first thing in the morning, bliss, perfect. But otherwise it's just a basic stamina positioning which helps me get through the day. I know that my 11 o'clock cup of tea is there, then my day is going to be all right.
So the question that I'm asking everybody is, how do you respond to the statement Christianity in the UK is not dying but sleeping?
Wow. My inner reaction to the choice is one of slight annoyance, if I'm honest.
It's not my comment, so that's fine.
Which is that both dying and sleeping imply a certain level of unconsciousness, that it really is out for the count, either one way or another. And I take issue with that. I do think that for a lot of people, well, for our secular culture as it is, it's more like it's a state of amnesia, and that it's never gone away. It's part of who we are. It's not something we can strip out of our identity, but that it's been forgotten, and the traditions of Christianity, the traditions in which much of the cultural life of this culture, of this nation, is built, have been forgotten. And within Christians themselves, I think there's a sense of not really having the language so much to talk about it as much as we did before, and it's become private in a sense of maybe a memory that somebody holds privately. As to what the answer for curing amnesia is, I'm not sure. I think it's remembering and retelling and literally, physically bringing the Bible, church traditions, church services, and the language of liturgy into public arena again, into dialogue, into conversation at all sorts of levels. I'd get excited about that, to see more of that happening.
I haven't watched The Royal Wedding yet, because I was busy on the day, and it seems a bit too much like work to do on sabbatical to watch it all through. I've watched the first bit of it, and I thought, I'm not going to watch the rest just now. I will try and watch it. But I've heard a lot about the sermon, and I was like, well, I think I've heard that the delivery was really good, but I'm not sure the content was very different from what a lot of people are saying every Sunday.
I think that's probably true. I think, well, I was sat watching it with some friends and with my husband, and him being ordained as well, he knew the words of the service and could recite by heart what was going on. And yes, I think the sense of love being at the centre of their relationship, and that was something he was preaching about, and the incendiary capacity of love. He kept talking about fire and starting a fire. That's pretty foundational in terms of biblical stuff, and 1 Corinthians, love being at the centre of who we are, and often that's read at weddings. But it was, I do think his delivery did something different, and it kind of made everybody sit up. There was certainly a bit of smirking and a bit of slight English embarrassment at what to do with this OTT expression, African-American expression of the gospel. But it was captivating. And I think the social media response has been positive on the whole, that here was somebody passionate and full of integrity and brimming with a wholesome, godly, alive message. That translated, and it translated across millions of people watching it. Even my dad sent me a transcript of the sermon that he got out from the paper the next day. He said, "You have to keep this, Shona."
I will go back and look at it in more detail at some point. Maybe I've got some time over the next 10 days. Next question. I'm really interested in your answer to this question. What do you think was the most important thing you learned when completing your PhD?
That's actually quite a tricky one, because there are lots of important things, and I struggle to identify the most important thing. Certainly one of the things was that I learned that it's easy to start a PhD, but it's incredibly hard to finish it. So it took me 6 years from start to finish. I had a year off in the middle, maternity leave, and then I went back part-time while holding down another job as artist in residence. So within that, the context of that was this whole idea of identifying and self-identifying what it is I want to be doing with it. What's important about it? What's important about the shaping of my identity through it? And in some ways, a PhD asks you to answer those questions by bouncing off everyone else, by saying, okay, well, I've read this person here, and this is what they think about my subject. Or, okay, this is what my supervisor thinks and the kind of direction I'm going. But actually, all of it is a filtering away of all of that until you get to the root of your interest and where you're coming from. And by the end of it, in a sense, the gift of that is having the ownership of a subject that is yours to the core and that reflects your facing of yourself in it. That feeling of ownership is something I didn't expect, and I didn't really know I was looking for. But when I found it, and when I see it now in the pages that occasionally I reread, I think, oh yeah, that's what got me fired up. And that takes you as a person on, I think, in life.
Because I did a science PhD a long time ago now, more than 20 years ago,
I finished.
But within a few years of having completed my PhD, so I did it in 3 years and 6 weeks. I had to do it quickly. I was working full-time in a lab. I was sponsored by the AFRC. Mm-hmm. And I had two supervisors. But what I really learned about doing my PhD was all about me and what I could do and what I couldn't do and what I was capable of. Mm. And I made some kind of advances in the subject and I became the world expert in my PhD, which is what happens when you're doing a PhD. But it was the self-discovery of doing it, which I felt was the most important thing.
That's not the typically measurable bit of doing it, is it? It's not necessarily the one universities want to know about. But it is really important. I feel like in my journey and in my faith, God had to get me to a point where the right PhD, the right supervisor, the right place would meet where I was in that sense. So I'd been thinking about and had conversations with different universities and different departments for about 5 years before this one came up. And this one came up, there was an interview for it because it was related to sponsorship from Bible Society. The interview came up a couple of weeks after I'd given birth to Amelie, my first child. And I went to the interview thinking, this is ridiculous. My brain is not in the right space. I have no idea what I'm saying when I'm answering these questions that these very intelligent people are asking. And yet, it was being in that space of a complete sense of, I don't know, unguardedness and take it or leave it, that this is who I am in the face of this climb that is in front of me. And if I'm a fit for the climb as you see it to these people, then hey, let's go. And I think that was the right place to be when that opportunity came up.
So the next question is kind of tied in with your PhD bit, which is, what would you like church leaders to understand about visual expression of Christian faith?
Well, there are so many different responses from church leaders about the visual arts. And I think I'm slightly speaking to my church background when I answer this question by saying that I get frustrated with the more evangelical tradition of church leadership, which would limit, I think, the sense in which the visual arts are part of God's kingdom by saying they're about illustration, they're about carrying a message. Essentially, to me, that shouts of a kind of propaganda strong arming of someone's gifts and abilities to suit a particular function or agenda. And I think the great gift behind visual expression is that it's not necessarily agenda driven like that by other people, that the space for creativity is very much a subjective but also non-linguistic way of expressing who we are as human beings and talking about God. You know, that we don't have to have things tied down to a logical argument about what truth is, but that there's something unanswerable in the way pictures work that isn't about language, that needs to be preserved. And I'd say, please, church leaders, please, if you are thinking about employing artists, protect the space for them to do stuff that isn't about articulating a message. Protect the space for it to be non-linguistic, even incomprehensible. And let's celebrate that. Let's say we're not afraid of it. So many church leaders are on the front line of commissioning stuff like that. Gloucester Cathedral has done a series of artist residencies in the past and has had major sculptural exhibitions. Durham Cathedral, Chichester Cathedral. Increasingly, there are church leaders who can accept and would want to celebrate the introduction of art on that basis, that it has something to do with another way of telling, another way of showing. So let's have more of that. Oh, and can we be paid too, please?
Yeah, those two things.
Yeah, I have a bee in my bonnet about, let's say a church leader would call in a plumber to fix the plumbing and they would expect to pay the plumber. But they can call in an artist to host something for a weekend with a saints festival or something and not expect to pay the artist. And I think that's just wrong. I think the expectation should be in place that that's the norm.
Mm-hmm. Now, I haven't seen the programme, but I've seen some of the publicity around it. It's from quite a while ago now. What was the most important thing you learned from being on the One Born Every Minute TV programme?
Dun, dun, dun. I love talking about this. So One Born Every Minute was 2013 when Dylan, my second child, was born halfway through this PhD. I always say that the PhD was like my third baby. Dylan was number two. But One Born Every Minute, well, practically speaking, I didn't find it a mental hurdle. I didn't find it invasive physically. The cameras were set up on the walls of the hospital in Southmead beforehand, and we were met in the car park at 3 a.m. in the morning when I had turned up, and microphones were fitted just as we have today. And then that was it. I didn't see anybody from the programme until 6 weeks after, maybe, after they'd done some editing and stuff. So on the day, it didn't really affect me. There wasn't anything particularly significant about that. But it was the process up to that point of chatting to the producers, of having the interviews, having our photos taken, getting the blurbs right for the possible TV highlight thing. That, to me, really framed the emotional and spiritual space of childbirth. And I had totally, in my art practice, just in my life, I'd been looking for a way, trying to find ways of identifying what was flipping happening to my body about this baby, and not really finding answers for spiritual and emotional expression in the typical NHS language of how you deal with it. You get your charts, you get your ultrasound, you get your yellow book with all the details and stats, and that's fine up to a point, but the significance of what's happening, I felt like I deeply wanted a way to talk about that and a way to articulate it and give it some voice. And the programme was totally, for me, a way of doing that. Before I even knew about One Born Every Minute, I knew that I wanted to make some artwork about the whole process. And I'd done a little bit of research into how the church used to celebrate the birthing of women. There was a service called, I think it's called the Churching.
It's called the Churching.
The Churching, yeah. And it's fallen out of favour because some of the languages can strike people as being a reference to how unclean the woman is after giving birth, and so there's a sense of purification needed before, or when the mother comes back into church, that there's a sense of cleaning, the ritual of cleanness. But when I look back at this service and I dug it out and I read it, and to me, it said much more about the value of the mother and the value of who she now was as this new person blessed with life in the church community. And I felt like a new person. And to read this back to myself made me think, gosh, yeah, this really does tie it all together. This is what it's about. And so, again, linking these threads together, I took the intention to the producers, and again chatting with my husband Adam about preparing for One Born Every Minute, we really wanted them to film the chaplain coming in afterwards, once Dylan had been born and we were sitting there in the room. So we asked for the chaplain, and they did film that bit very sensitively. We got him to read Psalm 62 over Dylan and say a prayer of blessing. And the producers edited it in such a way as to give that frame to the whole programme, to the programme that included two other couples giving birth as well, to a sense of the enormity of what happens in hospitals and in labour wards, and a thankfulness for it. And now I've watched it back twice, but each time I think, oh yeah, Psalm 62 in the middle of Southmead Hospital, bring it on. It really did give some light and some gospel and some hope right in the middle of that place. The artwork is still percolating in the background as it happens. It's taken a long time to come to term, to full term. And there's going to be a body of at least 30 pieces of work that come out of that. And the One Born Every Minute piece will be the showcase. But yeah, that time has not yet come, but it will.
Our roundup question is always, what's your favourite thing beginning with T?
Well, it has to be, we're sitting in Laycock, just across the road is William Henry Fox Talbot's home. And Talbot was the man who invented photography in England. And photography being my passion and being the way I express myself, my PhD research was all about photography. It has to be him. Go Talbot.
Thank you very much for speaking to me tonight, Shona.
Thank you.